Take it away.
Take it away, Dialogue Conspiracy. There were almost 2 years I've been on the air 1 hour a week talking about, first it started with the research with the John Kennedy assassination, and then the Martin Luther King assassination, and Robert Kennedy assassination, and now Dialogue Conspiracy goes into the thousands, literally a thousand or more, of domestic counterintelligence. That's what I'm writing about now, the article that'll be out in about a month called Murderville USA, Domestic Intelligence Inside United States by the Special Forces and Armed Forces and the Justice Department. It sounds a little shocking. I had a long talk with Jim Dunbar in San Francisco this week, who has never believed the conspiracy theory, but called back because a listener in KLRB wrote to him about the information that we have on this station every week, and people have been calling him asking about my research since the Watergate story broke, and I was on KGO last summer. And Jim Dunbar almost could accept the conspiratorial theory. He's holding back a while. He isn't the last word on believing or disbelieving, but there are a lot of people in the news today that would never accept this theory. And the next morning, when Mr. Kleinitz came out, the Attorney General, and said, if you don't like what Richard Nixon is saying, you can impeach him. The very next morning, Dunbar opened his show with the statement, this reminds me of what Mae Russell was saying yesterday, that Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan are puppets on a string. So it's getting in the stream of consciousness of the establishment, radio, media, in this country, the conservative Republicans are beginning to realize what's happening. The editorial writers are realizing what's happening in this country. So Dialogue Conspiracy is being exposed in the open for all the different connivances of the Justice Department, the White House, the law enforcement agencies, and the story will go on and on for the next 10 or 15 years. It's an important part of American history. It's important, I say, that the event... the rest at the Watergate was a turning point in oppression in this country, and that changes for the good would take place. I compared it last week to the invasion of Normandy, the beachhead. And once all those deaths had taken place and the troops landed and Hitler began to be pushed back out of France and back into Germany, and the war began to culminate, to come to an end, America was ending its terror of fascism. That was one stage of American history, to get over that immediate emergency of fascism spreading all over the world. Well, if the Watergate story is as big as the Normandy beachhead, then the tide of history has to show its effect every day. It can't just be that a few pieces of scotch tape left at the Watergate Hotel that disclosed the arrest of five people in the Democratic headquarters was so earth-shattering. So each week it's going to be my pleasure, from now on, and KLRB, to run down all the good things of the news of the week. For so many days or weeks, for 2 years, we've talked about all the bad things, the new laws of oppression and the surveillance and the grand jury system and the various people that were assassinated and the evidence of conspiracies. So today I'm going to run down a list of things just this week that are equivalent to, say, new towns that were taken in France when the troops landed. Every town that was taken and the troops reversed was a victory. So this week there were victories in the news, and I'm going to run them down to let you see how the story of the Watergate that's getting so much attention affects other facets of our lives. For one thing, the Congress got angry at Richard Nixon and said, you cannot dismantle the OEO. Richard Nixon tried a big power grab after the election. He said, I have a complete mandate. We're closing these offices. We're going to take away all these bills. And he escalated the war briefly. He still had the Watergate behind him to be investigated, and people were catching on to what had happened last summer. So in his power grab to dismantle all the programs that the Congress had passed last year and were working right now, he said, oh, I'll call a halt. He brought in Mr. Phillips, who's a member of Young Americans for Freedom, an extreme right-wing group, and he dismantled these. Well, yesterday, the judge in Washington said, no, Mr. Nixon, you can't touch that. Those funds are a program that were set by Congress, and you may not touch them, and OEO is back working. It can't be dismantled. That is directly related to the Watergate, because the grab of power, the centralization that Muskie referred to, that we're going to have a one-man government, the brakes are on now, and people in Washington, believe it or not, are catching on. The second motion was before Congress yesterday to limit the emergency contingency plans of the president. Now, that's important because James McCord, who was arrested at the Watergate, was head of a 16-man unit to declare the emergency contingency conditions for radicals and mail and radio communication. And because they planned to overthrow the governor in 1972 at the time of the Republican convention, but it was halted by the Watergate arrests, the emergency contingency group was revealed as being part of the espionage squad. So they pulled another one. Yesterday it was suggested by the congressional committees that they pass a resolution that the war-making policies of the president can only last for 30 days, and the emergency contingency, 30 days. That means that where we could have a martial law, like the Americans, through the funneling of Roy Ash, who's now in the Office of Management Budget, who helped overthrow Greece as a conduit of funds, he can't overthrow America for more than 30 days or he goes to jail. We won't have our martial law. I used to want to leave the country, go to Canada, get out of this country because I was afraid of the martial law. The congressmen have connected the contingency unit to the Watergate espionage group, and we will not have what we put into effect in South Korea with Mr. Parks or the recent test case of Marcos in the Philippines where the American government put martial law in there. We will not have martial law. I used to predict we would. I predict we won't. Now Congress is making the laws that say, no, Mr. President, you're not going to pull a 30-day emergency. Now, that's important because as the Watergate investigation went too hot, I visualized Mr. Nixon creating a situation or a disaster or a series of violences that would promote the emergency contingency. I call that domestic counterintelligence, the kind of escalation we had in Vietnam at the time that they wanted the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. We have the troops, but they're not going to have the ability to declare martial law in this country. The third point was that last week when Patrick Gray was out, just before we went on the radio, and they were talking about another director for the FBI, the congressmen have said clearly now, nobody involved with the Watergate should be head of the FBI, and furthermore, anyone who investigated it or is part of the Justice Department, we're going to separate. You see, the Attorney General is appointed by the president, so that's political. Robert Kennedy was the president's brother, and John Mitchell was the man who organized Richard Nixon's campaign. You kind of take politics out of investigating. You've got to have an agency that has no relationship to either political party that isn't appointed. So the congressmen say, okay, give us the name of a man who isn't political. Well, Richard Nixon can't do that because if he isn't political, he'd be investigating himself. Now, you may try to pull Sheriff Peter Pitches from Los Angeles, and I have a list of letters I would like to give you your homework before the show is over to write. But just to jump the gun, because we called it last week on Peterson, write to the Senate Judiciary, either Tunney or Sam Ervin, those are members of the Senate Judiciary, or any other member you like, and say don't appoint Mr. Sheriff Peter Pitches because we have to open up the Isla Vista provocateur story and the Manson story. That was Army Intelligence Massacre. Manson wasn't in those homes, and until we open up that story, Peter Pitches, you're not going to be the head of our FBI. It's a very political arm of the federal government conspiracies. We don't want any part of it. Until you open up who killed Ruben Salazar down there, the Sheriff's Department, you cannot head our FBI because you're involved in some major cover-ups of conspiracies. If you didn't plan them, you certainly covered them up. So you could write a letter to the Senate Judiciary before he even nominates the man to let him know that you're intelligent out there. You listeners are intelligent. Some of you are listening every week, some for 2 years, some for a year. You listen, you write letters, you're educated, you're reading books now. Just let them know that you're doing this. Don't just do it at home and pass it off as your homework. Keep writing letters and let the judiciary know that Peter Pitches isn't good enough. Now, this week we came to a subject that has not been in the news in the Watergate at all. It's the subject of impeachment. It came out in an article by Nicholas Van Hoffman that I'm going to read to you in a minute. It came out in the Los Angeles Times, a three-page article, April the 6th, Will the Executive Government Privilege Have Its Day in Court? And it suggests that the impeachment proceeding of Richard Nixon could go ahead. Just to quote two paragraphs from the Los Angeles Times, it said the president has only two choices with Mr. Dean, who he won't let testify before the Senate committee. First, Dean could the Senate could arrest Dean and order his imprisonment, and the power of Congress to punish for contempt has been upheld by the Supreme Court based on earlier precedents of English parliamentary law. Or the second, should the White House police block the Dean arrest, he could be subject to impeachment proceedings under Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution, which provides the means for removing from office the President, Vice President, and all civil officials of the United States. Impeachment must be initiated by the House of Representatives, but the Senate does the actual trying with a two-third majority vote required. If convicted, a person is disqualified for life from holding a federal office. Now, this is a three-page article. There are lawyers in the East Coast working out the impeachment proceedings for Richard Nixon at this present moment. The third article was Richard Kleinitz in the paper yesterday, who said that the president refuses to let his aides speak before any congressional committee, and if you don't like it, go ahead with impeachment proceedings. If you don't want this, you can go ahead and proceed. He said that very flagrantly because I assure you there are East Coast lawyers right now working on impeachment proceedings of Richard Nixon. And as I say, I'm going to read you the strongest article was by Van Hoffman in a minute. Now, another thing Congress is taking up starting was today, I read in the paper, the censuring of Richard Kleinitz, that they may censure him in the Senate for the disregard of the Constitution. Now remember, this is the Attorney General that was held up for nomination as Attorney General or appointment because of the ITT scandal. So all that Congress has to do, if they want to censure him in the Senate, is to open up the ITT. They'll get him on perjury and many other charges. Richard Kleinitz should be removed. John Mitchell's out of the Justice Department and Robert Mardian. And Mr. Leonard, the next should be Richard Klein. Then we move to California to Mr. Evel Younger and Ronald Reagan. We'll take one at a time because they're moving west. But they may censure Richard Klein for disregard of the Constitution. Now, another thing that I had in my realist article was that cabinet would go in 1972-73 as soon as Richard Nixon was elected, and so would the Constitution, because the plans to do away with the Constitution of the United States were set up by Richard Nixon and Warren Burger, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, included in the new Constitution no Bill of Rights and no trial by jury. But your Mr. Ervin is, Senator Sam Ervin is a constitutional authority. He spent 12 years studying the Constitution, and he's right on top of it today. There are two marvelous articles that I'm not even going to review or talk about because anybody who follows this program owes it to themselves to go out and get them or copy them at the library. One is Newsweek this week, and the other is Time Magazine. Time has a marvelous article on the Constitution and Senator Sam Ervin and how he's going to bring the thing back. The Constitution is like Tinkerbell in Peter Pan. It was about to die, and there's that little light going, you know, and it's coming back to life. But instead of clapping your hands, everyone write your letters, and maybe we'll get our Constitution back. It was just so frail, holding on by a little piece of scotch tape at the Watergate Hotel. But we're going to get it back by hook or by crook. And read about Sam Ervin, his defense. Now, it's an interesting thing. Sam Ervin's been in the Senate. He was a judge, a Supreme Court judge in his own state. He's been quiet in the Senate for many years. He spent 12 years studying constitutional law, and now he can sock it to the president. And I can identify with him because I've spent 10 years studying the conspiracies in the United States, so I can stand up to any one of these people and back my documentation. And when it's needed, it's here. I used it up yesterday up at a hearing I'm going to tell you about. I can apply the research I've done to all the assassinations, to any of these current things, and the people involved are totally unable to defend themselves any longer. They're up against a wall. There's nowhere to go but down, and they're going every day. I sound pretty gruesome or happy. I don't know which way you would call it. I'm not. I just enjoy, after all these years of seeing things get tighter and tighter and seeming no way out, to see these things take a reverse for the better, for a change. Now, another point this week was an article or several articles on the end of the Cold War. Mr. Allende went to the United Nations in December to say that the American corporations working with the CIA and armed forces created civil war in his country and economic chaos. He had a jubilant speech in Chile this week where he said this is the first CIA plot that benefited the victim. Well, the second one is the Watergate, and the United States was the victim. That the article that I'm doing for The Realist on Murderville, the second one, is how the American people have had a civil war caused by the same corporations and the same CIA. We've been the victim, and we're going to be the second person to benefit from a CIA plot as it unfolds. Now, when Melendi celebrates the fact that the CIA is stopped in their operations of Cold War, think of it this way as a victory in terms of people all over the world. We've overthrown about 100 countries that we've put in military dictatorships. And don't you think 100 people are watching Melendi in the United States and trying to figure out just how their countries fell down, like Greece or Brazil or in South Korea or all the countries that we've overthrown and put in fascist dictators? I have a list of 97, not counting the Philippines and the recent ones. It's about 100 countries that we put in military dictatorships, believe it or not. And the ones that are about to be overthrown, don't you think they're looking to see which CIA agent is in their office, how they're being sabotaged, where they can take their problem to the United Nations if their elections are changed? See, these are historic events because it's a turning point for the free world, the third world. It's a turning point because Melendi has made a point. It's been proven. It came from every office, from the White House on down. And the former head of the CIA, Mr. McCone, the president of ITT, he got all of them into one bag, and he has all the documents and testimony and go all over the world and show them what the United States did, and he's doing it. So everyone's going to get their heads together and figure out what we did to them. So when you read in the New York Times that the ITT means the end of the Cold War, it does, because when the methods are exposed, they can't operate anymore. Now, another thing that happened this week is the Yablonsky murder that we've carried on Dialogue Conspiracy a lot of times, the killing of Joseph Yablonsky and his wife and daughter. That was 3 years ago. And the people that were first arrested said Tony did it. It was for Tony. Tony Boyle was president of the United Mine Workers. And there was a series of denials for 3 years continuously. Oh, Tony couldn't be Tony who inherited the mine away from Yablonsky. No way. Well, by unraveling this whole thing, people are talking and talking, and the trials are going on. And the last testimony this week, New York Times referred to it, is the latest series of self-incriminating evidence of people are proving the responsibility they had. And a quotation from the New York Times said, the latest series of self-incriminating evidence against the documents, each implicating the other person higher up, goes up in the alleged murder conspiracy and has become almost biblical chain of guilt. A biblical chain of guilt. So what we're going to see, that took 3 years of the Yablonsky, what you're going to see, and I predicted it on this show now, I've made a lot of other predictions that have come true. I predicted that a major Democratic candidate, you know, running against Nixon would have to be murdered. And then right after that, Wallace was shot in May, just about weeks or two after that. And people used to call this station and wonder, and I'm making a prediction now, that the biblical chain of command of guilt from the Watergate is going to go from the Watergate possibly to the J. Edgar Hoover murder. I know he was murdered, but it's too touchy. That is too revolting from the handle. But they can go right to the Wallace shooting. They can go the Chappaquiddick accident of Ted Kennedy and who killed Mary Kopechne, who really killed her when Ted wasn't driving the car. Then we're going to go back to Los Angeles Ambassador Hotel, and then we're going to go back to Memphis, Tennessee, to who really killed Martin Luther King, and then we're going to Dallas, where the domestic intelligence civil war really started. And the chain of command is going to go back into history and forward, and you're going to see this going on for the next 10 years. Now, another way that people are catching on to the method that I put on the plus side of the news, and it's just a little thing, but it's a very big thing in the consciousness of people today, is Ronald Reagan's jet plane. I referred to him, you know, on Dunbar Station as the ex-Army intelligence officer, Air Force intelligence officer, like Ebel Younger, flying around like an actor who's a politician or Republican, right? Well, Reagan has his private plane. Cost the state taxpayers $525 an hour. He spent $52,000 since January. The taxpayers were billed for $44,000. $2,000 of it, $2,500, went to the Frank Sinatra dinner down at the Palladium that he flew down to attend for Frank Sinatra. Now, Ronald Reagan wants to be the president of the United States, or he's been selected as the next president when Nixon is removed. And he needs his plane for public relations, and he also needs it because he has a lot of people to see and a lot of connections. The memos can't be intercepted anymore in a government that is involved in espionage or secret deals like Herbert Kalmbach, Nixon's attorney, handing out the money. Ronald Reagan's team works like this, and they all work like this. You can't know who they see or where they go. So people began to ask, well, if we're paying for the bills, tell us, who do you see? Where do you go, Mr. Reagan? What passenger list is with you, and where do you land? He was asked last week. And Ronald Reagan said he didn't intend to tell us. He says, you're just nitpicking, see? He said, you're nitpicking and harassing me, and I vow I will not give in on this. Well, California isn't going to make an issue of this until Mr. Reagan can be connected to the same funding of the espionage Watergate team. He's holding his own. I won't give in and tell you. If you want to know, call my office. I'm sure that we can find out who was on his plane. But this is what Ronald Reagan said in Sunday's paper. He said the governor's security force said that they should not reveal the details on how his plane is used because the release of details would allow anyone to establish a pattern of what we do and how many security people travel. And also, we have versatility in landing at airports at little available commercial air service. For like Fort Ord, you can ask, what airports is he? Travis Air Force Base? What little airports does he go with? The commercial planes don't land, you see? So when you want to know what we do, the pattern of what we do, those were their words, or how many security people has, that is what we're talking about, an espionage system. Where do you go? How many security people do you have, and how many security people run the government that aren't Republicans? See, we're going to separate in the next few years, and constantly, we do always do this on this show, separate the intelligence agents from the Republicans or the intelligence agents from the Democrats, because the Democratic Party is infiltrated with espionage agents disguised as Democrats, sabotaging that party from the inside. So Ronald Reagan's airplane is questioned, and he's defensive, but people are on to how he travels and who he sees, and now it's up to him to be watched, and he's going to be watched. There's Reagan watchers. That's good. I just want to read one thing about the Watergate that Nicholas Van Hoffman had. We'll go a little bit about the Watergate news this week. We take it each week, what's come down, and there's a lot coming down. But the strongest commentary about Nicholas Van Hoffman talks about the morbid discussion of James McCord saying that his life is threatened, or Martha Mitchell saying her life is threatened, if they say anything. And Hoffman said, Nicholas Van Hoffman said, it has come down to that kind of talk about murder, and no one yet has imputed to the Nixon people this one crime of murder. That's his only protection now, is that they haven't accused him of murder. But it may come down to that kind of talk, as fear grows, that the center of organized crime in America may be the Oval Room of the White House. And as we sit here in Washington, the rest of America can't see it yet. This is from the Washington Post, that all the public officials read in Washington. It's so heavy, he says, dishonesty in government and corruption in high places are the slogans. And possibly most of America doesn't realize that the godfather is in for a second term, and he thinks the whole family won a mandate. The thuggery in White House is, after all, a new idea, and not a very nice one. He says it's too much for most people to absorb. It involves so many people in high places, so many dirty things. Keeping track of them is a full-time specialty. There's simple perjuries. There's cash money in attaché cases. There's scandal in every hall of the government. There is simony. There's conspiracy. The veins of scandal fissuring the marbles of every hall in the government. You see, I take time out from his article a minute. I've broken the Watergate down into 210 classifications. It goes into the Treasury Department, the Internal Security Department, it goes to the FBI, the CIA, the Armed Forces, the Police Departments. It goes in the cabinets, like the Secretary of Commerce and so forth. Nicholas Van Hoffman says, a person can hardly understand it, much less believe it. What is reasonably civilized public to think when the wife of the Attorney General is thrown down, shot with a hypodermic needle, and people refuse to relate what she says to what's going on today? It's easier to believe Ronald Riegler's cloddish lies, he says, or his denials. But the president's personal lawyer is tied up in espionage funds. He's protecting the White House lawyer. And Nicholas Van Hoffman says, we have no history to fall back on here. There's nothing, and he says, maybe America would be better not knowing, but we have to know. He said, the man, Richard Nixon,'s got something like 1,400 more days to serve, and if it's pinned on him personally, every one of them will be fouled. Every day will be a macabre, dishonoring irony as he moves from event to event. And some people here, not all Democrats and not all the rads or the radicals, are starting to say it, but it may come down to the fact that he should be impeached. We have 5 or 6 new shockers away from the idea of being taken up. But if we get even 150 votes in the House of Representatives, you'll see the country divide and bleed her ideals away. Now that's Nicholas Van Hoffman from the Washington Post. You might go, I left off some more copies of The Realist that I wrote in July, the issue with the Martha Mitchell Watergate story. It ranges from the arrest at the Watergate through Richard Nixon, the clandestine agent. I left 20 copies more at the Thunderbird in Carmel today for people in the area here to read, or they can send for the Thunderbird bookstore in Carmel, California. Because in there I say that if they investigate the Watergate, you will find the most fantastic duel in American history as it unfolds. And I put the effect, the same thing that Van Hoffman is saying, the country will divide and bleed her ideals away. The ideal of America isn't going to actually bleed away. We're going to get back to something that the way America was meant to be in the first place. It was going down the drain so fast, and the Watergate thing, again, is broken. I want to go in. Last week, I suggested that people go up to Sacramento because dialogue conspiracy involves a lot of things. It involved a hearing, which I attended yesterday, from the Senate Health and Welfare Committee. And I went up to Sacramento to attend the hearing. It was chaired by Senator Anthony Bielenson. I left my work and research here because it was worthwhile to go. 2 months ago, Ronald Reagan, in his State of the State message, said he was going to start a school at UCLA to study violence. And he gave about 3 or 4 reasons why this first-of-a-kind institute would be very valuable to study the origins of violence. And I put aside my Watergate work. I've been reading it constantly, cross-filing, but I decided to wait and write on it after I did my homework on the School for Violence, because it was one more tenet of the fascist, the way the fascist regime takes hold. Now, the important thing was in the fall of 72, the government planned martial law, and they also planned the emergency contingency unit. And part of the emergency contingency unit has to be to control specific people that aren't murdered, like in Nazi Germany, to control their brains and do lobotomies and take the political leaders and alter their minds. And I became very suspicious of this particular institute, and so I took 2 months out to write an article that centered around the institute. And on March the 25th or 26th, there was a little more information in the San Francisco Chronicle on it. But based upon those two articles and using 10 years' research, and I have 1,800 different subjects that I go into or try to cross-file if I have the time, but in my head they're pretty clear, I went up to Sacramento to the hearing yesterday, and it was an education. And I'm going to read you my conclusions, and then I'm going to get out a brochure on it this week and have it mimeographed and mailed to various members of Congress and the Assembly. And if any of you want to write to the Health and Welfare Committee and ask for the minutes of that meeting yesterday in Sacramento, you can read it yourself. The Senate Health and Welfare Committee up in Sacramento, the hearings on the UCLA Institute. My conclusions on the Institute were this. About a few years ago, Mr. Wellesley Lieber, CIA lawyer from the Warren Commission, went out to UCLA Law School, and he was going to teach a class on the Warren Report, and I wrote a letter to Chancellor Murphy at the time and the Dean of Law School and said, how dare you use tax money from the state of California to pay the faculty to whitewash a federal conspiracy? And I really, it was about a 10-page letter. I sent letters all over the country, copies of that letter, how deeply I resented the use of the state university to cover a federal crime. So in this case, people, if they feel so inclined, could write to the chancellor of UCLA now. His name is Young, Mr. Young, Dr. Charles Young, chancellor of UCLA. Or you could write the dean of medical school, which I'm going to do, and tell him you resent the use of that university to alter political prisoners' minds in the state of California. That's what it's going to be set up to do. Well, people went to the hearing yesterday. There were three people there. They call him Jolly West, who's going to be the head of the institute. He's in the neuropsychiatric department now. Jolly didn't look very jolly. He looked like the Fuhrer's grandson sitting on that stand, and the only time he really smiled, they tried to give the image that he was a hippie, and he was really one jolly old guy. Wow, everything about him, you know, you could have put the armband on him with the swastika and you'd know right where he sat, but the terminology didn't fool a lot of people over there. Well, Jolly West was there, and a Dr. Littman was at the hearing, who, if the money goes through, would head the Institute to study behavioral sciences down there and the origin of violence. And then you have another gentleman from California who has the Health Committee, Mr. Stubblebein, Dr. Stubblebein, who was recommending this would be a great thing to have down at UCLA. And let me tell you what went on at the hearing. It's a first-of-a-kind institute to study violence. Well, one of the things that became very clear that I'm going to be writing up was that they had made up their minds they would have this institute. Whether California gives them the funds or not, it was part of a federal program. Therefore, you have to attack it at a federal level. They were asking Sacramento for $1 million. That's why the appeal. And Bielanson and a very good group. There's another senator up there, Bear, who did some hard questioning yesterday. They want $1 million from the state to help them get started. But it's quite obvious that if the state doesn't give the money, they intended to go through with it anyway. Now, the excuse Ronald Reagan had, they asked him, how do you want this study to study violence? Why do you want it? They said, well, after the Wallace shooting, Governor Reagan decided it would be important to find out what causes people to be violent. Well, every time there's a political assassination done by the CIA, then the repressions come down on the people even tighter. Like they say, well, we'll study people like Bremer. They should spend the $1 million and find out where Bremer traveled or got his second gun or who shot the second gun in Maryland. But that's not the kind of violence they want to do. So the cover excuse was the Wallace shooting. Now, Jolly West moved out to California from Oklahoma. He said he got interested in violence after John Kennedy was killed, and his excuse was to study Jack Ruby's kind of violence. Not who Ruby knew in the oil business or Tony Genovese or the Mafia or any of that group. He wants to know why Ruby shot Oswald, you see. So this group wanted to know where Dr. West came from. And Dr. Stubblebein said, well, Dr. West is really being very modest. They want to know what team would be working with you. Where will you get your staff from? How will you draw it? And Dr. Stubblebein, very modest, said, well, I'll tell you, Dr. West is being very simple about this. He's not telling you, but he has such a large following. They came out with him from Oklahoma, the whole group. He's brought his faculty with him to UCLA, see, and the team, in other words, is all set up. So one of the things we have to do as researchers is get the name of every man on his team and find out how he's connected to the government or the Central Intelligence Agency. He's brought his crew out there so that they're going to have a team funded by federal money tampering with California minds and bodies. Now, they want the state to give them $1 million, but then the California criminal justice system would supply the rest of the money. Just by coincidence, the California criminal justice system is the federal government that has given $40 million to law enforcement in California, $40 million. This would be the Auschwitz of America. George Jackson called Soledad the Dachau, or San Quentin the Dachau. This is the kind of operation, the military operation, where the man moves west, moves his team, the money's available. But what they did, they tried to pass it off as a public relations job. And Ronald Reagan gave a very proud thing. We're going to have the first of its kind. And Jolly West was surprised yesterday that everyone didn't jump on the bandwagon. He thought that this is his cover-up. What are you long-haired hippies doing representing the poor or the minorities? Why don't you just have a firing squad? To the fact he thought his opposition would come to the right wing because he's so kind to study the violence of the oppressed. That was such a public relations job, really a cover-up. The truth is that his excuse for having this thing is that he wouldn't deny the benefits of medical science to a poor person who was violent in our prison system. You wouldn't deny him the privilege of scientific medical care. You know, they never had an arrangement to know why this particular person is in prison, but they're going to be very altruistic and not deny him the latest of medical science, like lobotomies. Well, the examples they used as the justification for this kind of thing is, we want to study the violence of Jack Ruby, or if we had known the Whitman boy in Texas, and we're going to study the American Indian and child battery. Well, first of all, Jack Ruby worked with the federal government. He worked with the CIA. He worked with the organized crime. He worked with the oil people. He was hired to kill Oswald, and then he was killed. Ruby's violence, they'd never pick up at the Institute. The Whitman boy was involved with the FBI. That Institute would never study him. They're going to study Chicanos and blacks and American Indians. The Whitman boy was an American white Christian, sang in the choir, was an Eagle Scout that went on the tower and killed those people in Texas, the 30. They would never pick up that kind of a boy any more than they would get Charles Watson. Charles Watson was a boy from Texas working with Beverly Hills lawyers who was protected by judges in Texas so he wouldn't be tried with Manson, who killed 7 people in Sharon Tate's home, 5 in her home, 2 in the LaBianca home. Nobody's going to study Charles Watson's brain. They'll study Manson's brain. Manson didn't kill any of the 7 people with a crime that he's alleged to have committed. Charles Watson, you see, all the do-gooder, good student, or the Mullen boy down in Santa Cruz now that's being held for these very 10 murders, they're not going to study those brains of these white children from military families who are employed by the system and get off from the legal system or protected. They're not going to study those kids growing up in the suburbs of America, going to church on Sunday at the Boy Scout meetings. That's where the violence is coming from in every one of these cases. No, the Institute is going to study the victims of the oppression, not the oppressor. Now, Dr. West, they asked him, what kind of drugs would you use? Would you use things like anacetin that cause paralysis that are very painful? Would you use those on your prisoner subjects? And Dr. West says, I wouldn't approve of anacetin. I hardly disapprove. I have no intention of using such drugs. And he's saying with such sincerity, that's no part of my program. But sitting with him is Dr. Stubblevine, Dr. J.M. Stubblevine, psychiatrist, state health director, who uses anacetin at Atascadero, San Luis Obispo, Vacaville, San Quentin, who uses Prolexin, who uses electroshock treatment. These men should be brought before the United Nations for breaking the Nuremberg Code and the codes of the AMA. They're using it every day as I speak now. They're using it on somebody in this state. It's illegal, it's criminal, the person has no defense. And while Dr. Jolly West is telling you that it's beyond his beliefs to even think of such a thing, Dr. Stubblevine knows perfectly well that he's using it at the present moment. And they asked him, would you do psychosurgery on any of the people that you diagnose? And he says, I would never do psychosurgery, but down the corridor there's a stretcher going where they're doing it today. They're already doing it, so whether you like it or not, UCLA Neurological does the psychosurgery, and so will the prisons, and we want to use your prisoners. We won't do it at our institute. We're just going to rent an office in West Los Angeles, but psychosurgery is done by other people. Well, that was the hearing. I'm going to be writing a lot about it. The article in The Real is coming out in another month called Murderville USA is centered about the institute. Because the article won't be published for about a month, I'll get a short brochure out about these men and the hearings, so that we can get word to public officials. I actually think, because it's federal money, the gist of my article is this: federal money is involved in silencing particular people, like Martha Mitchell said they tried to put her in a mental hospital after the Watergate thing. Mrs. Hunt was going to Chicago with the names of neurosurgeons, and she had money to silence the men that her husband had hired to keep quiet. They could have altered their brains if they didn't plead guilty. Last week we talked about Alex Bottos, who has absolute evidence of the conspiracy to sabotage the plane that Mrs. Hunt was blown up on with 45 other people, the United Airlines, December the 7th over Chicago. Alex Bottos, who has the evidence of the conspiracy, is now in the federal penitentiary at Springfield, Missouri, in the mental hospital, kept as a prisoner arrested for no charge, mental hospital. That is where we're going. It's a federal problem because federal money is used. Federal purposes to hide conspiracies are used on lobotomies, and it goes into the state that California justice is really federal money, and these men have to be stopped. We have to, the gist of the letter I'm doing is that we have to stop this institute till the Watergate is thoroughly investigated to see how the espionage links to California. We have to stop it till the Lewis Tackwood book comes out in June linking Ebel Younger and the criminal conspiracy section and Squad 19 to the espionage group. And we have to stop it till we get a complete research of every doctor that Dr. West brought with him from Oklahoma. Then the UCLA Institute will be through if we move quickly. One reason my article is taking so long to finish for the Realist is that as these things come on, we have to move on them. Well, I've got 7 minutes to do a little bit of the Watergate news for the week. I can't run down all the sources. The newspaper, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, I take daily, have sections like every other newspaper. Foreign news, news in Asia, like Cambodia and Vietnam. They've got news, you know, women's wear and theater section and all domestic and the different sections the newspapers have in the sports. They actually have a whole Watergate section. One whole page is devoted to Watergate of every issue. It's pouring in and it's massive. So if you get to a library, there's Washington Post or a New York Times, read them every day. Biographies of the people involved, excellent material. Time this week, and Newsweek magazine and Time magazine, and then Realist at the Thunderbird. But a few things on the Watergate that came in. Charles Colson, CIA liaison in the White House, who works with Carl McIntyre and Premier Key, the top man who hired Howard Hunt. He's the top of the whole espionage group from that group. Howard Hunt worked at the White House. He had a desk there, walkie-talkies that connected to the group. It was Howard Hunt, the desk that Mr. Patrick Dean went into, and the dean went into, the lawyer. And Patrick Gray was dropped from the head of the FBI, and Richard Nixon chose the side of Dean to protect him against Gray because they cannot reveal anything about Mr. Hunt's desk at the White House. Well, Colson hired Hunt. Now, Colson's name is brought in, but the trials haven't started yet. The grand jury hasn't called him in, or if they have, we haven't heard what they said. He hasn't been subpoenaed to the Senate hearings, which will be starting in 2 weeks. But Colson jumped the gun. He had himself given a lie detector test in New York this last Saturday, and I want everyone to know he passed it. He said he'd give himself the first lie detector test that he wasn't involved. Now, he asked himself 5 questions. He wrote the questions, but he wouldn't say what they were, and he gave them to the lie detector company, gave it to him. And to buttress his testimony, the scientific lie detection company gave it to him. Well, the ITT, CIA, Howard Hughes front sent out information to check out Dita Beard in the memo. We don't know who the scientific lie detector company is. It wasn't done under any group objective, giving him questions, catching him off guard. He gave himself one, probably a test run to see how it goes, and he says he passed. So the man has cleared himself. He's been tried and cleared. He's acquitted. According to Charles Colson, you don't have to worry about me. I'm not involved. When I read that he gave himself the lie detector test, he passed. It reminded me of my research of Jack Ruby in Volume 5 of the Warren Commission hearings. I wrote a play called Tiger by the Tail, and the first act is Jack Ruby's testimony with Earl Warren, and the second act is the polygraph test that Jack Ruby gave, where he writes his own question and words them over and over again. And when it was all done, he's passing beautifully that there's no conspiracy, that he knew Oswald. Ruby says, well, is it all over? And they said, yeah. So he said, well, shouldn't you ask a question like, are you a patriotic citizen? So the lie detector man who was giving it said, are you a patriotic citizen? And Ruby says, yes. Now Ruby says, well, maybe we should ask another question. He says, are you a 100% American patriotic citizen? And they said, okay, we'll ask that. Ruby wanted that asked. So they gave him that, and the polygraph machine went going, and they said, Mr. Hendren said, are you a 100% American patriotic citizen? And Jack Ruby said, yes. So Ruby wasn't satisfied. He said, now, wait a minute. There's one other question to finish this lie detector test to show there's no conspiracy. Ask me this. Are you a 100% law-abiding patriotic American citizen? And so the polygraph test is, are you a 100% law-abiding patriotic American citizen? And Ruby says yes, and then they say the polygraph test is concluded, and he passed it. Well, how many million Americans saw Jack Ruby shoot Lee Harvey Oswald handcuffed inside of a jail, and he passes the polygraph test that he's law-abiding? So therefore, the law of the land is, it must be, if you pass that test, that you can murder in front of 3/4 of the population of the United States, and the law says you can go ahead and do it. Well, that's the kind of a polygraph test that Mr. Colson probably passed. He writes his own questions, and if he's patriotic and law-abiding, he can be like Jack Ruby. So he cleared himself, but don't believe he's cleared. Now, another thing, James McCord said that he was paid by Mrs. Howard Hunt to keep quiet, and he revealed this week that since the Watergate arrest, he alone got $21,000 cash, and so did all the other men, in these crisp $100 CIA bills. Again, $21,000 for James McCord and for each of the men that have been arrested. As your taxes come due, you know, this week, $21,000 for each of those men. And James McCord said he didn't think anything of it. It was like payment to dependents of American prisoners of war. It was just simply to keep quiet. Now, put that together, that they're being paid like prisoners of war. And they asked him, well, why did you get so much? This is twice the salary you got when you were even working for the committee. Well, each man's been promised $1,000 a month plus more all the time he's in jail. $21,000 each man paid by Mrs. Hunt. Last week we talked about Mrs. Hunt's plane being shot down. I got information, blown up rather, or crashed in Chicago. I got information this week that there's positive evidence that a man parachuted from the plane before it landed. This is from Sherman Skolnick, the same researcher that gave the other information about Alex Baldus being in the mental hospital and the sabotage of the altimeter on the plane. Now, Newsweek had an article that Mrs. Hunt was going to 5 other cities after Chicago. You see, if people on jet planes land at private planes, then all this doesn't begin to come out to the public. Now, one other thing, Maurice Stans, who's in the accounting profession, he was the Secretary of Commerce, has been reprimanded, and the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants is going into the background of Maurice Stans accepting slush money and making a settlement of the Vesco company because it involves a swindle of the Security Exchange Commission that was settled with John Mitchell arranging certain things at the Justice Department in exchange for a measly $200,000 in cash in a suitcase, again, not listed in the Republican Party. For that, $214 million was swindled off the Security Exchange Commission, and there's a plea to the Ethical Division of the Investigation of the Accounting Profession to go into Maurice Stans. So that's it for a week. This is Dialogue Conspiracy, but the investigation of Maurice Stans is one more plus that the public accountants are getting into it now. Everybody's into the act. So that's it for next week, and we'll see you next week.